Today on Maine Calling, stumbling around the world with veteran NPR producer Peter Breslow. Colleague Scott Simon says Peter Breslow is one of the people who helped to make NPR. Breslow says he faked his way into a job at the network back in 1982 and spent the next 40 years cutting interviews, recording field stories, traveling to dangerous assignments around the world, even climbing most of the way up Mount Everest. His new memoir, Outtake, Stumbling Around the World for NPR, chronicles many of his stories about what it took to get the stories and what it was like to be at NPR in the early days. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the show, I'll talk with Breslow about his long career as a journalist, often behind the scenes, and about his most memorable experiences. Maine Calling is coming up. I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Radio producers are usually behind-the-scenes people, like our own Jonathan Smith, who help the host, people like me, ask insightful, thoughtful questions. They also schedule the guests, and sometimes they get to travel to exotic places to follow the news or scout out possible radio segments. My guest today spent his career making great radio. Peter Breslow was a longtime senior news editor, rather producer, at NPR, working on programs including All Things Considered and Weekend Edition. He's written about his work and his adventures in his memoir, Outtakes, Stumbling Around the World for NPR. He's currently residing in Maine as he teaches a class on audio journalism at the College of the Atlantic. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever wondered what a public radio producer does? Any questions about the inner workings of NPR? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. And just a reminder that our Maine Calling number is different than the number to call for Maine Public's membership drive. The Maine Calling number, again, 1-800-399-3566. Peter, welcome to Maine Calling.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So as I just mentioned, you're in Maine now. You've got a teaching gig. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've actually been teaching for a while. I teach at Colorado College. I've been doing that for about 9 years. And, I did that for many years while I was working at NPR because the kids there take one-month courses at a time. So I was able to take a leave and go do that super intensive one-month audio journalism kind of boot camp. And then last year, I was invited to come up here. And we were lucky enough to have friends in Southwest Harbor with a great house. So we stay there, my wife and I and Sadie, our dog. And I'm teaching here, and then this is my second year, and cool, interesting place. I never knew about it until I got invited up here, and got a nice group of students, and it really is. I tell them it is the least academic class they're ever going to have because it's pretty much a radio production workshop. So. If nothing else, you walk out the door ultimately and you actually have a skill, hopefully.
Well, that's what they're there for, I'm sure. Let's start at the beginning of your beginnings when you were first learning this. You acknowledge wholeheartedly that you kind of faked your way into NPR in 1982. You had no radio experience. You'd never taken a journalism class, although I would argue that shouldn't be a prerequisite. But after returning, so you've been traveling, you return, I think you were in South America, and you return to the U.S. and you begin listening, or you spend more time listening to NPR, and then you decide, maybe I'd like to try that.
Yeah, I started listening. I guess I had some roommates. I was living on this old funky farm when I was in college, actually. And that was my first, somebody said, you should listen to this lady on the radio, which, it ended up being Susan Stamberg. And And then I vanished, and I was, yes, wandering around South America for a couple of years, just wandering. And I came back and really had no marketable skills. I could write pretty well. That was about it. But I had never really, I didn't even know why. I just had never really thought about journalism. And then upon my return, I started listening more. And I started, I can maybe do that. So I wrote letters back in times when there were these things called typewriters, and I mailed them to all the executive producers of the many fewer news programs they had back then at NPR. And everyone, send me back a form letter and we'll keep your resume on file. But there was this one guy named Stephen Reiner, who was the executive producer of All Things Considered. Steve later went on to become a producer for 60 Minutes and running the journalism program at Stony Brook. And he saw something in, so I had nothing to lose, right? So I wrote this kind of gonzo letter, just a bit irreverent, throwing everything in from the fact of my travels to that I was an Eagle Scout. And he kind of liked that I had this adventurous spirit. And also, at that point, I spoke Spanish and Portuguese because I had spent part of my time in Brazil. And, at that point in the news cycle, Latin America was very much one of the big stories. All the Contra War in Nicaragua, the civil wars in Central America in general, and then some of the Latin America, South American countries transitioning to democracy. So he invited me. The story goes on and on. Yeah, so well, stop me. Yeah. Right now, it's,
well, it's
he
interesting.
Invited me down.
Yeah, well, it's interesting yeah. you say that you had no marketable skills, but he must have been thinking about this, right? That, we might need someone who can speak Portuguese or who's familiar, who's capable of traveling. Was he thinking about that at the time, or he just generally liked your act?
I think he liked my kind of New Jersey wise-ass sense of humor. But yes, you are correct. Because of, as I mentioned, that the news story was Latin America at that time. Amazingly, this was so crazy. So because of my Portuguese, I finally did, after many faux pas and borderline disasters, which I talk about in the book, and almost missing deadlines and slashing my fingers with razor blades when we were trying to cut tape with magnetic tape and razor blades. They sent me on a presidential trip with Ronald Reagan because he was going to Brazil, and I was pretty much the only person at NPR who knew any Portuguese. And I was so green. And they sent me with a State Department reporter who was, I'm sure, thinking, oh my God, this kid doesn't know much. But it was so exciting it was so unheard of. I mean, in the first place, I'd only just started working at NPR and I was going on a presidential trip. And lo and behold, 39 years later, it was the only presidential trip I was ever to go on for my entire career. And that was a eye-opening experience and so exciting. And, I just loved it. I loved the filing on deadline and collecting tape. And, we did this whole secret trip to interview Commander Zero, who was a dissident Sandinista up in the mountains out of Costa Rica, and kind of a clandestine journey. And it just, lit a fire in me. And that trip kind of got me into the track of foreign assignments.
But I read also there's another incident that kind of is a moment for you where you realize, gee, this is what I want to do. And I also want to go back to the first day when you're there to meet Steve Reimer on your first day. And what I love about it is you write that you hitchhiked to your first day of work, which is so apropos of the time. And Steve Reimer isn't even there on that day. And so they're not even sure whether to let you in. So this is this is an awkward start for you to begin with.
It was. And I actually, funnily enough, I recently reconnected with Steve. We had lunch, and he didn't remember the incident at all, but he apologized profusely for not being there. So a guy named Richard Harris, who was the line producer for ATC, All Things Considered, he was like, "What? Who sent you? What, do you know how to do anything?" And I was like, "Steve said I could come." So anyway, I showed up, and they made the mistake of letting me in the door. And I was smart enough to find out who knew how to do this stuff, which again was cutting tape, which was the bread and butter back then, of interviews, which we called two ways, with a razor blade. And it turned out I was really adept at it. I was really fast, and I was really good at making decisions of what tape to keep and what tape to dump. But the moment that you referenced was my second day, and I'm just standing around, right, trying to not get in the way. My second day there, it was February, I think, and so it was very icy, and that's actually why I hitchhiked in, because the city was frozen solid and the public transportation wasn't going, and so I hitchhiked to get to NPR. But anyway, day two, an Air Florida jet crashed into the 14th Street Bridge and sank into the Potomac River. And it was this huge event, a terrible, tragic event, right in NPR's backyard. And, you know, the newsroom explodes. Producers are running out to get tape. Editors are banging away on, again, this is back in the days of typewriters. People are making phone calls. I tried to make myself useful and not get in the way. But it, as I say, it was this god-awful, tragic event, but it was exhilarating. And when I saw really how a newsroom functions and how people pull together to write scripts and pull tape for the stories and get it on the air and run into the studio on deadline, it was like, oh man, this is exciting. This is something I think I'd like to do.
You also became part, as you discovered, of a very social place where the bonds of friendship were strong. You write that there have been some 80 NPR marriages over the decades. Who keeps track of that statistic, by the way?
So my good friend and former neighbor, Susan Stamberg, who in that chapter where I talk about my early moments at NPR, I was cutting a two-way for Susan, and I hadn't written the intro was in a very rough state. And again, this was typewriter days. And so I had to run in the studio. I completely lost track of time. The producer says, "Get in the studio now." I run in with this script on 3-ply paper, and the info is all there, but I had drawn arrows to show Susan. I didn't have time to rewrite it. I had to show her where, what to read and when. And, you know, I'm trying to explain to her the countdown clock from the previous piece is ticking down. And I'm explaining to Susan, and then the mic opens and I have to shut up. And Susan starts reading the script, and it's okay, okay. And then she stops, and I realize she's lost her place. But consummate professional that she is, she figured it out. And she continued and read the script, and, you know, the mic light turned off, and she said, "Honey, you need to get yourself a watch," which I didn't have. And we ended up being good buddies, and we traveled all over the world together. And amazingly, we ended up living across the street from each other up until recently. And she was, and still is, sort of the great aunt to my my twin daughters, who were infants at the time, but are now 24 years old. And, you know, she was the person who kind of shepherded me a little bit and took me under her wing, and I think felt a little sorry for me.
And at some point, you're recognizing that, wait a minute, Susan Stamberg is well known by everyone who listens to NPR, and yet I'm doing all this work, but no one knows who I am. Did the realization come upon you slowly? How did you feel about the role of the producer behind the scenes?
Well, this is the lament of producers, right? You kind of take one for the team. You're behind the scenes, and you need to suppress your ego a bit, and but we all have egos, and certainly I do. And and at least for many years at NPR, at the end of the show, they would say your name. And then at some point, some brilliant news manager said, we're going to stop with credits. So, you know, the one day of the week on Fridays when my mother would tune in to hear her son's name on the radio, that ended. But, you know, I would always, you are being a little selfless, but it's also collaborative and a lot of fun. And I have been so hugely lucky. I mean, the epigraph to the book is about luck. And there have been so many instances of luck helping me out. And one of the big things is that I've been lucky enough to work in the field with terrific NPR people and correspondents. And, you know, NPR really was my journalism school, my journalism grad school. And going out with Susan or Scott Simon or John Burnett or Lulu Garcia Navarro, even up until my last assignment, I was always learning something from these people who were so great.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those experiences. But first, we're going to have to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be back soon.
Maine Calling is made possible by listener contributions and by Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping Maine homeowners improve comfort and efficiency with insulation services. More at evergreenyourhome.com, and by Center for an Ecology-Based Economy, presenting Living on Earth Steve Curwood at the Climate Convergence May 17th and 18th, ecologybasedeconomy.org.
And you are listening to Maine Calling, donor listener-supported Maine Calling. Hi, I'm Scott Marshallton here with Susan Tran, and we are thrilled to be here just for a few minutes to remind you that it is your support that fuels programs that like we are listening to now in Maine Calling. I love behind the scenes conversations, and Peter Breslow, longtime NPR staff member, worked with so many amazing talents, folks that you and I have met, Susan, the wonderful people, very dedicated to the craft, to the mission of public broadcasting, made possible when you call 1-800-866-1475 or go online at Maine Public and share your support to fuel the things that we're doing like this today.
That's right. I was listening to that amazing list of folks that he was just kind of talking about at the end, who were, you know, the colleagues that he kept learning from, like, you know, throughout his time at NPR. And I was just like, if you know the people on this list, which you probably do, then you've been listening for a long time.
Then you're a part of the family.
You are a part of the family. And if you're already a part of the family that gives, thank you. We appreciate your support. If you haven't given yet, now is the time to call. Call in honor of Peter Breslow and of Susan Stamberg and of Scott Simon. Call 1-800-866-1475 with that legacy of great NPR voices in mind. Again, 1-800-866-1475.
And when you make a donation as an Evergreen friend at the $10 a month level or more, you if you ask for it, you get a new Maine Public Evergreen Friend t-shirt, which is a fun t-shirt. We have some here in studio. So no matter the reason, really, it's important that you do call today. Mm-hmm. Share your support. Be as generous as you can be. If you're an Evergreen friend already, today would be a great time to increase your Evergreen support in an amount that makes sense for you and your budget. Maybe you're comfortable where you are. Maybe you just increased your Evergreen friend support. Then make a one-time gift to support Radio Pledge, to support Maine Public Radio right now. There's so many reasons. Let us know why you care about Maine Public. Let us know why you support NPR. You support the programming that you hear every day on Maine Calling, but call 1-800-866-1475.
That's right. We have a room full of volunteers here in our Portland studios, and they're here. They've volunteered their time, and they want to hear from you. Make their time worth their while. Give us a call, 1-800-866-1475. They are happy to talk to you, and they really want to know about your reasons for giving, for listening. So let them know when you call. 1-800-866-1475. $14.75.
Just one more minute before we go back to Maine Calling, our regular program. I wanted a shout out to some folks. I was earlier this morning, I had a phone call from someone who was listening who wanted to become a member of the Beacon Society. Oh. She'd heard us on air. That's a donor giving level of $100 or more a month as an Evergreen friend, or $1,200 or more a year as a one-time gift. We've got the average gift there is about $2,400, mm-hmm. folks that do that. So if you're someone who's been thinking about making that gift, like Jacqueline was, give us a call now, 1-800-866-1475. Obviously, that's a gift to support the programming that you're listening to now, but also your community. It goes extremely a long way here at Maine Public. Again, 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainepublic.org. Back to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're learning about the life and work of a longtime public radio producer. With me is Peter Breslow, the author of a new memoir, Outtakes: Stumbling Around the World for NPR. He's currently teaching a class on audio journalism at the College of the Atlantic. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, comment on our Facebook page or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Peter, you recall a trip, an assignment that had a big impact on you in your early years was to Vietnam, and you accompanied a Vietnamese writer who had fled as a teenager during the fall of Saigon in 1975. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was Duc Nguyen, who so sadly he recently passed away. He was just such a great guy. More of a poet, really, than a journalist. So back in the day, I was kind of in charge of commentators for ATC. And Duc was one, and he had decided that he was going to go back to Vietnam, which he had fled back in the 70s. His dad was a regional governor in Hue and had been captured during the Tet Offensive in 1968. And Duc didn't see him for a dozen years, I think it was. And eventually Duc made his way to California. And actually he was on the radio at KUOW, I think are the call letters in the smaller station in San Francisco. And we ended up going, and it was just this great trip. But the main goal of the story was to retrieve his sister's ashes. And his entire family got out of Vietnam, but his sister, who was mentally ill, didn't leave, and she died young. And they were Buddhist, and she was cremated. And we went back, and one of the goals, as I say, was to retrieve the ashes of Duc's sister. But it was such a great scene. You know, we went down his old street and we knocked on doors, and there was his aunt opening the door, who hadn't seen him since he was a little boy. And here he was, a 30-some-year-old man. And just there was this great, great audio moment. And as a producer, that's what your ears are always tuned to, right? Find the seminal moment that helps tell the story. And so this is 1989, and you know, Americans are pretty rare in Vietnam, and people and kids would see us with our microphones, and they would just go ballistic and kind of swamp you like you were a rock star. Anyway, we ended up at this temple where Duc's sister's ashes were held, and there was this just amazing moment of, and I had a sound technician with me, so I didn't have to worry about screwing up the recording. So Duc is chanting a prayer in front of his sister's ashes. The kids who had followed us are outside the temple screaming their brains out. There's a monk who's ringing a bell, and there's a cloudburst, torrential downpour, and all these things. It was like a live mix of all these cacophonous, wonderful sounds. And this was like day two of the store of a 5-week trip. And, you know, and when you're a producer, you're always looking for the great sound. And I knew that if nothing else, I had this absolutely astounding moment. The funny end story to this tale is that, so it's pretty hardcore communist time in Vietnam. And we wanted to get these ashes out of the country. And we figured there'd probably be all sorts of hoops to do that. So we decided we were going to smuggle them out. So we took them out of the urn, put them in a shoebox, and continued our reporting, which went on for weeks. Anyway, the day before we're about to leave, Duk gets called into the police office. And as I said, this was kind of hardcore government at that time. As a matter of fact, some of the people we interviewed, the police went to their homes afterwards to ask what we were asking about. And so I'm in the hotel room sweating. Oh my God, they found the ashes and they're going to, like, I don't know what they're going to do to us. And an hour later, Duke comes back and he said, they found the urn that we left in a hotel room and just wanted to make sure that we didn't need it. So we ended up smuggling the ashes into Thailand and then I think probably smuggling them back into the United States. And, you know, they ended up on the mantle at Duke's family home in San Francisco. But it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. And, you know, I have such fond memories of him.
It's interesting that you talk about the stories in terms of, because this is what you were thinking about, was the sound that you were going to capture during them. And there's one story, and I'm giving Sam, our producer here, a heads up that I'm going to ask for a clip in a moment here. You take a trip to... you're assigned to go to Mount Everest and you were to climb the mountain. And first of all, you can just set us up. You're equipped with a satellite phone, which is not the satellite phone of today.
That is correct. Yes.
Not yet. Hold on, Sam. Yeah.
Okay. Want me to continue?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I always did a lot of outdoorsy stuff at NPR stories. And so when we found out about this expedition, they funneled it to me. And I found out that there was going to be a sat phone. And so I got to scheming. And after months of dithering, NPR finally said, okay. And I really, with just days' notice, I ran to the local REI and bought long underwear and got on a plane and headed to, approaching the mountain from the north, so through Tibet. So it was a long trip to China, then Tibet, and then overland from Tibet to the base camp of the mountain, where on the Chinese side, unlike the Nepalese side, you can actually drive to 17,000 feet and actually get to the base camp. And this was really the trip of a lifetime. And the reason I went was because they had a sat phone. And you know, sat phones today are the size of a laptop, and I've taken them all over the world for all sorts of war zone reporting and other reporting. But this sat phone was gigantic and had to be powered by a generator. And it was housed in this hut at base camp. And there was this very petite, it was so funny. There was a little petite princess phone, if you remember what those look like, that was the phone that you talked on. And so I would do interviews with NPR and I would trudge up the mountain. And so the phone was at 17,000 feet. But, you know, my reporting took me up as high as 23,000 feet. So I would do reporting and then I'd have to trudge all the way back down to base camp, which after spending time at advanced base camp, which was 21,000 feet, which we can get into. But, you know, to get back to base camp at 17,000 feet felt like Miami. I mean, it was warm enough to, you know, boil water and take a shower after three weeks. Yeah. But anyway, cueing you up to the tape. So that was So my goal, I mean, I'm not a true mountain climber. I'm athletic, but, you know, I had days notice, so I hadn't trained or anything. But I do okay at altitude, or at least I did back then. And my goal was to climb to the top of, it was called the North Col, which is 23,000 feet, which is kind of a 2,000-foot climb, pretty much ice climb with ropes and ice axes and crampons and all that. So I decided I was going to, the way to do it would be to mic myself. So I had back in the days of cassette recorders, and I had a little lapel mic, and I was wearing a climbing jumpsuit, and I put a Sony Mini Pro, I think is what it was called, with a little lapel mic. And I just turned it on and started climbing. And so the challenge was, I knew it was, my envision, I was thinking, you know, I'm a producer, so I was thinking like, well, how's this story going to pan out? And I was thinking it would perhaps work as a non-narrated story, meaning that there would be no script and I would just supply the tape. So, you know, the tape is just rolling and I'm breathing heavily and I'm just narrating whatever pops into my head. And, you know, you're a bit oxygen deprived.
Right.
Let's
hear that, because I want the listeners to get a sense of it. It tells the whole story, really. Anyway, Sam, go ahead.
Big ice racks on either side. Places that look like they could have avalanches. Hopefully not this way. I got my beeper in my pocket. But that's definitely the last way I want to go. It's getting squished in an avalanche.
I think that the tape just, you know, again, it just sort of tells the story of what you're going through in that moment.
Yeah, actually one of the best compliments I ever got. So that was tape that we rebroadcast after I returned. So we were able to play it in full fidelity using that sat phone. We only had phone quality. And so it was really difficult to hear what I was saying, but you could get the panting. And I remember after I got back, and a colleague, a great producer, said to me, you know, I couldn't understand a word that you were saying, but I couldn't turn away from the radio. So that was, you know, that felt great. And I guess part of the joy of my job was that, you know, I was the listener's surrogate. So here I was, pretty much not a real mountaineer, but I got to be in this place that most of the population will never get to visit. And I was getting paid to do it. So I get to represent the listener, you know, in my portrayals. And it really was a trip of a lifetime. I was gone for 3 months because there was so much bureaucracy. And when we were trying to get to the mountain in the first place from Tibet, there were landslides and earthquakes and delays and delays and delays. And finally, you know, I did make it up to the North Col, which at that point it was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. And then a couple of weeks later, I went up again and I had acclimatized better, and it really was so much more easy. And so that was 23,000 feet. I spent a month at 21,000 feet, which was advanced base camp, which, you know, I would not advise anyone to spend a month at 21,000 feet. And we did establish one more camp, Camp 5, at about 25,000 feet, but that was it. And then these huge winds struck the mountain and pretty much shredded the tents, and we had to retreat. And unfortunately, the expedition ended up without us being able to summit.
That's quite an adventure. All right, we need to take another break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Community support is what makes Maine Calling possible. Together with John T. Gorman Foundation, investing in two-generation approaches to help strengthen the resiliency of Maine children and families. JTGFoundation.org. And by Farnsworth Art Museum, inviting you to First Fridays every month of the year for free art, community, and more. FarnsworthArtMuseum.org.
And as George just said, this is community-supported Maine Public Radio. Good morning. Susan Tran here again with Scott Marshallton, taking just a few minutes out of this fascinating Maine Calling discussion to do the business of public radio, to come to you. This is one of four times a year we come to you. This is our spring membership drive, asking for you to become a part of the team that makes Maine Public Radio happen. Won't you give us a call at 800-866-1475? A large portion of our budget comes from our listening community.
That's right, Susan. Over 75% of our operating budget comes during drives just like today when you call 1-800-866-1475 or when you go online at mainpublic.org. Hit that red donate button.
That's right.
Please be as generous as you can be, but do support Maine Public Radio. We rely on you. We rely on our audience members to call in or to go online to support us during drives just like this. Join Gabriel Olson from Conway, New Hampshire. Gabriel, thank you for your support. Or Jonathan Minot from Southwest Harbor, Maine. I love it, what he says. It's Maine Public's like a magazine. I love to listen, and it's great news. We thank you, Jonathan, for that. Gretchen Fall Sawyer from Albany Township, Maine. If you know where Albany Township is, you're one of the few out there. Actually, I know where Albany Township is. It's a beautiful area of Maine. Thank you, Gretchen, for your support. Folks calling in from New Hampshire, from Maine, from all over the state, being as generous as they can be, sharing their support, standing with Maine Public Radio. We've got an election cycle coming up. Yes. We've got a lot of work in front of us, and we need audience support.
That's right. You know, and a lot of people have been calling in this today in particular, but in the last 2 days, to increase their Evergreen Friend membership. If you're new to Maine Public, you may not know, but our Evergreen Friends program, they are listeners who donate to Maine Public Radio on an ongoing monthly basis. In fact, more than half of our members choose to become Evergreen Friends. It's really easy for you. It's best for Maine Public. You decide how much you'd like to donate each month, set it up to come out of your bank account or charge your credit card. And every time you turn on the radio, you will know that you are having a positive impact here in Maine, in your community, as an Evergreen Friend. 1-800-866-1475. You can become an Evergreen Friend by calling that great number. We have a room full of volunteers, or you can, of course, do it online at mainpublic.org.
And Thursday, we have a thank you gift today. If folks, when you donate $10 or more a month as an Evergreen Friend or $120 one-time gift, you can choose the new Maine Public Ringer T-shirt as a thank you gift. It's a heather gray and navy blue around the sleeves and collar. It's a retro design.
It's fun.
I think we're aging ourselves with the retro design, bringing us back to our 70s attire here. I've got a PBS shirt. I don't know if it's still, I don't think I can wear it anymore, unfortunately. It's a little threadborne, but with the classic logo. It's your support, just a small way of saying thank you for supporting Maine Public Radio, having a little bit of fun today on this Thursday during our spring membership drive. Give us a call, 1-800-866-1475. Back to Maine Calling.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, a look at the life of a public radio producer and his adventures. Peter Breslow is my guest. His new memoir, Outtakes, Stumbling Around the World for NPR. Join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Again, the number for Maine Calling, 1-800-399-3566. I want to shift to journalism. You say you decided that maybe it was time to wrap things up at NPR sometime around the time of the pandemic. Studios were closing. Everything was by Zoom. The newsroom atmosphere was gone, and the field assignments were fewer. Was it just time for you, or did all of that contribute to you deciding maybe it was time to move along?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I thrive on the field assignments. I mean, I was but my main job was as a line producer, which, you know, that is hardcore deadline, sometimes grueling work. And I started to grow you know, each individual show would be exciting, but I started to grow tired of that grind. As you mentioned, you know, the assignments just started disappearing. I started feeling just a little bit like an old white guy, and I'm a little bit of a irreverent, maybe not the most politically correct sometimes. And I just felt like I really couldn't joke around like I used to, and maybe it was no longer appropriate. I just kind of felt maybe better quit while I'm in my head.
Yeah. Well, this we have to talk about this, which is, we're all aware of the sort of the controversy is swirling around NPR, which is sparked by the former senior business editor Uri Berliner's open criticism of NPR's news coverage. He has since resigned, but this has brought NPR into the spotlight and facing more allegations that it's gone rigidly progressive, you know, internally and outwardly in its reporting. What's your take on that?
You know, I respect Uri. I used to play basketball with him. He's a very good basketball player. He's a great, great editor and has done some amazing stories too. But I just have to say, my experience is not what Uri's was. And, you know, I've been gone, coming up pretty soon on 3 years, and maybe things changed more severely after I left. But I would say my take, I still believe it, that, you know, yes, I mean, the people that tend to go into journalism tend to be on the liberal side of the political spectrum. I mean, it's just whatever reason that, and there's all sorts of reasons why that happens, but I think that is the case. But that doesn't mean that you are not fair and forthright in your reporting. I still feel that, yes, you could pick, and I think Uri very much cherry-picked in his critique, stories. But I think if you look at the coverage in the aggregate, I should maybe preface all this by saying, you know, my experience is very much shaped by working on Weekend Edition and a very tight, small group of people led by Scott Simon and for a lot of the time, Will's Leanne Hansen, and then briefly Audie Cornish, and then Rachel Martin, and for a long time I worked with Lulu Garcia Navarro, all incredible, incredible journalists. And I always felt like, if anything, we bent over backwards to give, you know, because we were always we're always cognizant of the rep that NPR has as being overly liberal organization. So especially Scott, just being so cognizant of that and trying to go out of our way to give the other side a chance to speak up. And I think you could pull apart any individual story, not any, but certain individual stories. But I feel, and I still feel this way, if you look at the storytelling in the aggregate, it's balanced. It's fair.
There, we also know that overall, there's distrust of journalism throughout the United States. What is fueling that?
Well, you know, political, I guess maybe a lot of it stems from the hardening of political ideologies and people feeling their side is right and just listening to the silo of information that agrees with them. And so, you know, anything counter is just, I mean, was it Trump who first came up with the term fake news, which, you know, it's stuck. And, you know, I mean, there are, the right has moved further to the right, and some of the left has moved further to the left. And I just feel like people have kind of hardened in their positions and are less open-minded to maybe at least question their assumptions. And that, and if you're only listening to a news source or reading a news source that's kind of telling you what you already know and what you already believe in, then things just become even more, set in their ways. And I think journalism, you know, we just have to just keep doing what we're doing and be cognizant of that divide, but keep holding truth to power and keep holding people's feet to the fire and being honest in our approach to stories.
Yeah. I want to end with a story from the book, from your travels, which is the story of the Miraculous Love Kids Music School. This was an effort by you, I think I read, to find people making the best of a bad situation in Afghanistan. Could you just sort of quickly tell us about that? And then I have a clip after that.
Yeah, I often on my stories have tried to find something uplifting. One trip to Afghanistan, I did a story about the women's cycling team. And on my last visit there, that was 2017, I went with correspondent Tom Bowman. We were actually embedded with the Marines. But during a time that we were off from that, we found these kids. And there was an arena rocker named Lanny Cordola with a long ponytail who played with members of the Beach Boys and Guns N' Roses. And he heard this story about a young girl she went out to sell trinkets on the street in Kabul with her sisters. And she went in one direction and the sisters went in another, and they were killed by a suicide bomb. And Lanny was very touched by this. He was working with musicians in Pakistan. He found his way to Kabul, found Mursal, and found out she had an interest in music, and he started showing up with guitars. And when we caught up with him, he had formed the Miraculous Love Kids Music School in Kabul, and teaching young women to play guitars. He was buddies with Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, and they started collaborating. And Lanny taught them how to play Love and Mercy, and Brian Wilson sent over voice tracks, and they mixed them together to create this amazing song that, you know, if you're going to play it now, I'm going to get chills again down my spine when I hear it.
We are going to play it again now.
I was sitting in my room and the news came on TV.
Short excerpt there.
And I'll just mention that I still keep in touch with Lanny, and most of those girls made their way to Pakistan.
Yeah. Peter Breslow, thank you so much. It's been an interesting hour. Peter Breslow.
Thanks so much, Keith.
Peter Breslow's memoir, Outtakes, Stumbling Around the World for NPR. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. I'm Keith Shortall. This is Maine Calling.
Maine Calling is made possible by your support, along with the Maine Pottery Tour, celebrating ceramic arts with 70 studios around the state, including Homeport Pottery Studio in Kennebunkport, mainepotterytour.org, and by Bernstein Schur, lawyers who will dig deep into your matter as a part of your team. Learn more at bernsteinschur.com.
You are listening to listener-supported Maine Public Radio. That was Maine Calling, our own Keith Shortall interviewing Peter Breslow from NPR, talking about all sorts of things.
Oh my gosh,
over the
they
map.
Went all over the place.
we were at NPR Studios. We were at Everest. We were, I don't know where we were on that last piece, but we listened to some music there. All made possible when you call 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainpublic.org. This is our spring membership drive. We're asking you, our listeners, to call in now or to go online, share your support with Maine Public Radio.
That's right. We're here in the Portland studios. It's very busy. We have a room full of volunteers who are here to answer the phones. And I will say, in the spirit of Maine Public being a representative of Maine being a big, small town, one of our volunteers actually is the daughter of the woman who hired me 20 years ago. Isn't
well,
that
there
amazing?
You go.
Yeah.
Only in Maine.
It's all connected. But they would love to hear from you. They have given their time. And so let's make those phones ring so that we are giving them something to do. 800-866-1475. That is the number to call to become a member, to make an additional gift, or yeah, those are the things you can do when you call.
what right now we're doing, if you're a relatively new listener, this is our fundraising drive. This happens to be our spring fundraising drive. We go on air four times a year, or mostly quarterly,
yeah,
asking for your support. What we do when you share your support, your generosity, you make your gift to Maine Public. Again, you can do that now. Call 1-800-866-1475, or as Susan mentioned, you can go online at mainpublic.org. When you make your gift during a drive like this, it pays directly for the programming.
It does.
100% of it goes directly to the programming. Some of what you're listening to now, we just finished up with Maine Calling. Here and Now is coming up. Other programming is coming up. That is what your support dollars go during drives like this, right to our programming. So again, give us a call, 1-800-866-1475. Susan, you know what? We've had a bunch of calls this morning, this afternoon, from donors who are increasing their Evergreen Friend support.
I love that.
Which we really appreciate. So David Coleman from Bar Harbor increased his sustaining Evergreen gift. Ned Sampson from Peaks Island increased his sustaining gift. And William Frolick from Rockport increased his sustaining gift.
Wow.
Won't you join them? If you're an Evergreen Friend donor, join them. Increase your support to Maine Public. You can do it right now.
1-800-866-1475 is that number to call to increase your Evergreen Friend membership. You know, and I think it's worth mentioning, if you've been an Evergreen Friend for a long time and maybe you haven't really thought about the level that you're giving at in some time, this would be a great opportunity to give us a call, see what level you're at, and maybe add an extra $2 or $3 a month, maybe an extra $10 a month. Because I have to say, we are in budgeting time, and all of the programming costs money, and as I look at my budget for the new fiscal year that starts on July 1st, surprisingly, none of the costs have gone down.
Unfortunately,
they're
not.
Just going up. So if you are able to also increase your Evergreen Friend membership, that will help us, frankly, buy the programming that is going up every year. 800-866-1475 is the number to call. You can also take care of this online at mainpublic.org.
Again, and the of course the costs go up as
yes,
everything has, but the value you're receiving that we receive, I'm an audience member too.
Yes.
Susan, you are as well. It is well worth it.
Yes.
It's actually more than well worth it, frankly. I have the pleasure of speaking with people all over the state, and not only are folks feel like they're supporting programming specifically, but they're doing something for families who couldn't support programming.
Right. Paying it forward.
Paying it forward, or couldn't, couldn't subscribe to Maine Public.
Mm-hmm.
Understandably, there are news subscriptions out there.
Yep.
We are not one of those services. Our service is free and over the air.
That's right.
Won't you join that caller now when you call 1-800-866-1475?
That's right. And just a quick reminder, you are listening to Maine Public Radio. WMEF Fort Kent 106.5, WMEH Bangor 90.9, WMEW Waterville 91.3, WMED Calais 89.7, WMEM Presque Isle 106.1, WMEA Portland 90.1, WMEP Camden 90.5, and everywhere in the world at mainpublic.org.
And we are everywhere in the world, and we've got donors from every state in the U.S. Won't you join them with your support when you call 1-800-866-1475? You know, we talk, we say it, we kind of read through it. You're listening to Maine Public, listener-supported Maine Public Radio.
That's right.
We say that often. We thank you for your support. We couldn't do this without you. It's a unique partnership. We partner with you as audience members. You support us during drives like this. Give us a call, 1-800-866-1475.
That's right. Maine Public is different from every other public radio station in the world, frankly. We are a statewide community licensee. We serve the state of Maine, and that makes us different from any other service out there. Won't you support your public radio station here in Maine by calling 800-866-1475 or giving online at mainepublic.org?
Again, 1-800-866-1475. 1-800-866-1475 is the number you can call. You can go online at mainepublic.org. Again, be as generous as you can be, but do support Maine Public Radio. This is the time we're asking you for your support. Susan mentioned she's in charge of all of our programming here at Maine Public and is part of the purchasing team that finds the things that are out there to program on Maine Public Radio, and it's your support that makes that happen. 1-800-866-1475.